Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You've built a great podcast. That content's solid. The audience is growing. But the money? Still not where it should be. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. We host your podcast for free so you can keep doing your thing while our experienced sales team does their thing, finding advertisers and bringing in revenue. No fees, no stress, just real monetization. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.
This is Kevin Hagelin from 105.3 The Fan. Please enjoy this following special edition of our I'm Listening series.
Portions of the following program have been pre-recorded.
Talk saves lives. The three words that best encapsulate why we're all here today. Welcome to Odyssey's I'm Listening. I'm Carson Daly. So thrilled to be back once again hosting this very important conversation, shining a spotlight on mental health in this country, and giving us all a space to reflect on our own mental health. We're going to spend some time hearing from our favorite artists, too, on how they look out for their own mental well-being in their daily lives and when they're out touring and on the road and, of course, online. Plus, we're going to be joined by mental health experts who've become our friends over the years and very trusted partners here in helping us all to learn about our mental health and craft important conversations in our households and beyond. We've got important mental health resources you should know about. They're listed at imlistening.org. We invite you to go there to check them out. And if you're in need of help at any point during our show, or at all for that matter, please, we invite you to call or text 988. That is the latest national suicide and crisis lifeline. And just like you would call 911 in an emergency, please use 988 for mental health emergencies where experts are standing by to help you. So I've been rather candid over the years about my mental health journey. In fact, I never thought that if you had asked me when I started at MTV, you know, would my sort of, you know, life legacy be rooted in mental health advocacy at any point, I probably would have said no. But it has, and I'm really proud about it. And let me start by quickly just saying this is the mental health stat that I always put out there that I think surprises a lot of people. And I think it gives a really good snapshot into sort of where we're at in mental health in this country. And that is this. The time that elapses between when the average person experiences a mental health symptom, when they start to go, something's not right, and when they actually go get treatment or seek help, right? So that time, how much time goes by? The average amount of time is 11 years. Think about that. 11 years from when you're red flagging, something's not right upstairs, I'm not feeling great, to when you actually, okay, I'm going to go see somebody or get help. 11 years. So that says to me that there are millions and millions and millions of people who are suffering in silence. And I know that's a fact because I was one of them. My mental health journey starts really at when I decided to start talking about it on the Today Show. And I said, you know, it really started with a panic attack I had had at MTV. I was dying a slow death on the air as I was experiencing panic attack symptoms, and I had no idea what a panic attack even was. It wasn't until I read an article by Kevin Love, the basketball player, later in my life that I realized, oh my gosh, he expressed during an NBA game the panic attack that he had had. And I was like, wow, I'm not alone in this. I would eventually go on to get into cognitive behavioral therapy and get diagnosed and then learn a lot about kind of the model of anxiety and all that kind of stuff. And it became really the best thing that ever happened to me was being diagnosed. And now talking about it and talking with others and sharing my story, I think is people have told me has helped them out, just like Kevin Love did for me. One person's story, could be your story listening to me right now. Trust me, there's somebody out there that you're going to help out a lot just by talking about it. And whether it's on stage or screen, field or court, or in your regular work life, whatever it is you do, or school, it's becoming more and more normalized to hear from celebrities, some of your favorite musicians, athletes, talking about their own mental health. Thank goodness. I think that's really helped normalize it in the pop culture conversation nationally. And you see these people that you know and you see on TV and they're high functioning. You're like, hey, if they're going through something right now and still able to be successful, then you know what? I can do that too. In fact, here are just some of the conversations so many stars have been having. Let's hear from some of our guests who implement a variety of ways they tackle their own stresses and anxieties. Cynthia Erivo,
when we talk about mental health, we seem to think it's a taboo thing, but it's something that we're all in some way dealing with. And I think the more we talk about it, the less afraid we are of having the discussion. And actually, that's the way we get to better ourselves.
311.
You gotta be outside more than you're inside.
Yes.
If you can help it. And it can be as easy as that, you know, just to get out of your normal routine, whatever, take a walk, find a hike.
Turn off the screen.
Bring a homie.
Lisa.
Post Malone. Like Sunflower. It's really lift my moods up. Taylor Swift. It's like, shake it off, you know? It's like, ah! It's being in my bathroom and my shower. It's like, ah! You know?
Kylie Minogue.
I try to, like, do the right self-talk. I can't say it always is that way, but then I've always been able to count on my family just to be able to say something out loud, and just saying it, you can often deal with it. I'm so glad it's the conversation is happening now.
Lewis Capaldi.
This time around, with doing therapy and focusing on getting better, I was really saying to myself, I'm going to do this thing and I'm going to get to the end of it, and I'm going to make sure that everything that I promise myself, I'm going to follow through on.
And on our side, our great team is back together again this year. I can't tell you how much I admire the folks that are here for I'm Listening. Odyssey's Katie Neal, of course, host of Katie and Company, will be joined throughout the show by one of my favorite people on planet Earth, my sister from another mister. That is the great Dr. Alfie Breland Noble, who is an incredible psychologist, founder of the mental health nonprofit, the Acoma Project. They do so much great work. Dr. Alfie's a rock star. So we're lucky to have Dr. Alfie here with Katie. And also Dr. Christine U. Moutier, psychiatrist and the chief medical officer at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. I've had the good fortune just this past year doing a little bit of work with that organization as well. And I can't tell you what kind of angels they all are there, especially Dr. Christine Moutier. So we're glad that we're all here together to try and help so many people out. We'll begin our conversation talking about our kids, protecting them, supporting them, and as parents, navigating all the things that kids and teens can go through. Throw in social media and, of course, now AI. And there is a lot to cover. So let's get started. Katie, we'll send things over to you.
Thank you, Carson. I am thrilled to be back for another year of I'm Listening. I believe so deeply that talk saves lives. And I know from personal experience that normalizing conversations around mental health can greatly increase the quality of your life and the lives of everyone around you. The first topic that we want to dive into today regarding mental health is children and families. We'll be talking to both Dr. Christine Moutier and Dr. Alfie Breland Noble. Dr. Moutier, if parents are having a hard time finding ways to talk to their kids about mental health, what are some of the things that they can do?
First of all, taking care of your own mental health is a really important first step in just kind of becoming more conversant in how it works for you. The more comfortable you are, the more kind of sophisticated you get with the topic, I think the more genuine you can find ways to work it into the family environment. So that dinner time, driving in the car, just regular day-to-day activities, you kind of have a lens on how your kids are doing in terms of their mental health, just like you do for other aspects of their physical health and their safety. It just becomes part of life and part of kind of a, you know, everyday sort of healthy framework that you're thinking of in terms of raising your kids. When you're in your most well state, and it doesn't have to be perfect, of course, nothing is about perfection here, far from it. But when you're living authentically, you're taking moments to ground yourself, all of those, that sort of those messages, the nonverbal cues that kids really pick up on all of it. It's not, in fact, it's not as much what we say, right? It is what we do. And it is that environment and that energy in the space. So the more you do to take care of yourself, take care of your marriage, if this is, you know, if the family is around a marital partnership, those are things that can contribute to a child's positive well-being and their own kind of best psychological development. There's a lot of research on trauma and ACEs. It's the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. And there's numerous studies, but there's one that's very long running. And it finds that many, many kids are exposed to these adverse child experiences anything from, again, having unaddressed mental health, addiction, a parent who is incarcerated, even a divorce, as kind of lesser as that may seem in comparison to these really significant kind of traumatic experiences, all of them are categorized as potential ACEs in a child's life. And the more they have, the more that piles on, the more it is likely that these children go on to have some challenges with physical health, mental health, school functioning, graduating from school, getting employed, I mean, all of the things. And but there's also good news that those kinds of experiences can be mitigated by support, by one steady caring adult in the child's life over time. That does not even have to be a parent. That can be an aunt, an uncle, a coach, a teacher, someone who takes an interest and is a steady anchor can change the outcome for children who are exposed to those kinds of adverse childhood experiences.
And Dr. Alfie, thank you so much for being here. Is there anything that you would like to add to that as far as small steps that families can take to make conversations around mental health easier to have?
One of the things I love, I learned this a long time ago when I was a grad student, and I was working in Madison, Wisconsin, and they used to start the sessions with, they would call it the weather report. And they would say, how was your, right? And so you would give your assessment of your day and your emotions based on like the weather, like so sunny, obviously, right? It was a bright, sunshiny day, or it was gloomy and horrible and it was rain, or there was a tornado. And I really love that because it's a way to sort of a fun way, interesting way to get at having those conversations. The other thing I like to encourage people to do is when you have little kids, find books, movies, TV shows, that kind of thing. Even if you have not so littles, that can give you something where you're both focused on what you're watching or what you're reading. But then you can kind of slide in some of those side questions like, oh, how do you think so-and-so was feeling when that thing happened to them?
I love each of those. I think that using, you know, bringing it in, bringing the conversation in when you're talking about a TV show, it's not about us, but it normalizes those conversations. And I love the weather report. And I think that people can take that and make that a part of their own families. Like if weather doesn't work for you, maybe it's like, what song do you feel like today? And you get to use a genre, all these different things. Like find out what is the thing for your family that makes it feel the easiest to talk about.
Yes, I love it. Yeah.
If parents are having a hard time finding ways, or maybe they're trying to implement these and they aren't working, what are some other things that they can do? Like, I always feel like, you know, leading by example, maybe talking about your own mental health could be a good thing.
Definitely that, Katie. Like, there's nothing better than leading by example, because when you lead by example, what you demonstrate is what your family or what you personally value. And what's a better value than we care not only for our physical health in this family, but we care for our mental health. So the same way that parents do things like, you know, cut up fresh fruits and vegetables, and those are snacks rather than giving them candy and chips all the time, right? Like there's nothing wrong with candy and chips, but not all the time. And so little things like that, where, for example, when my kids were little, they used to watch me meditate. Not like they would stand there and stare at me, but they would walk past my room at a certain time of day. And I was on my mat, crisscross applesauce, you know, with my fingers in position and meditating, or just with my eyes closed, or just reflecting, or even laying down. And so having them see that demonstrates what the values are in your family. I think as well, having conversations about what not to do, right? Like for parents, it's like, this is the thing I got wrong. So somebody said something to me, I was feeling some kind of way about something else, and I blew up at them. But then I had to go back to them and apologize, because what I was yelling about or what I blew up about was not about them. It was more about me. Being able to teach our children that we're not perfect, that we make mistakes, but we know how to assess and then correct our mistakes. All of those things contribute to good mental health. And then the final thing I'll say is things like exercise. Having your children or the young person you care for or mentor or parent or caregiver for, having them watch you engage in activities, journaling, exercise, talking to a friend, watching you make an appointment for your mental health provider. All of those are things that you can personally do that your child or a young person in your life can watch and understand that you place a high premium on taking care of your mental health.
Dr. Alfie, thank you so much for being here. Now we'll check back in with Carson.
Wow, thanks, Katie. That is some really great stuff there. These stars joined us to talk about mental health and their own relationship with social media.
Amy Lee.
I think that social media is one of those things that we have to use sparingly. It's so hard. We're so addicted to our phones. I limit myself. I really do. And that is good for my mental health, to just get off the screen, get outside, go, you know, live life for real. Social media can be a real void.
Alex Warren.
I'm still figuring it out.
Yeah.
I'm not used to, like, because I think with the success of Ordinary, it's been really cool. But the problem is now people who don't like me have, like, kind of like a, who the hell is this guy? You know what I'm saying? So it's definitely been like, if I have an off day or if I'm sick and I still go out and sing, it's definitely kind of like a, see, he's not that great.
DDG.
I mean, I think over time, like over the years, I developed a really thick skin on the internet. It's just like a boxer. You know what I'm saying? If a boxer is doing warm-ups where he's taking a lot of body shots, when he get in the fight, you know, he's going to be able to eat the, you know what I'm saying? And it ain't nothing.
Shirley Manson.
You know, I'm lucky, like, I'm old, so I just don't really give a f-. I mean, it's easier. The older you get, the more experienced you become, the less you take it seriously. Also, there is the great block button.
Jenny.
The most effective is to just stay away. Literally, you have to kind of force yourself to be like,
listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
You've built a great podcast. The content's solid. The audience is growing. But the money? Still not where it should be. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. We host your podcast for free so you can keep doing your thing while our experienced sales team does their thing, finding advertisers and bringing in revenue. No fees, no stress, just real monetization. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.
Whoa. Like, take some time. Go out. Take a walk.
Tate McRae.
Get off of social media and focus on yourself. Learn more about yourself. I think that's the best way to live life, is to try and learn as much as you can about others and yourself and your real reality, not just the one on your phone.
Jesse Murph.
Lately, I think I've just been not looking at the comment sections because I don't think they ever... I never leave feeling like, oh, that was a good thing to do. And then I try not to scroll. Scrolling is actually just not good for your brain.
Katie, we'll send things over to you.
The next topic we'd like to discuss is social media, and this is a topic that we cover almost every year on I'm Listening because we know both the positive and the negative effects it can have on one's mental health. New to that mix this year is now AI and the effects that it is having on social media and everyone's mental health. What have you seen in the last 6 months or so, Dr. Moutier?
Yeah, AI is just everywhere, and people are leaning on it, you know, for good and for bad. You know, it's such an assist in all of our lives now. You know, I think with a lens on mental health and particularly suicide, it's really important to realize that many of these platforms were not built with our human condition, including our mental health or suicide risk, in mind. And so while some of these new platforms are making claims to solve issues around loneliness and provide companionship, I would really just have a word of caution, especially for parents, but for anyone who is using these platforms. And for parents, it's obviously to be involved in your kids' lives so you know what they're doing online. Some of these things are so ubiquitous that they may be using them and we just didn't even realize it because it's just kind of going under the radar and they're on their iPad and you may not even have recognized that. And so there are platforms where there are characters that will become a buddy or a companion. And there's some research, emerging research, that shows that as part of the algorithm of how these AI chatbots are built, they tend to mirror back statements that the person, the user, is making. So if the person is experiencing, let's say, depression or anxiety, and they're expressing these experiences and thoughts and feelings in onto the platform, the chatbot will often reflect them back in a way that kind of confirms those negative distortions of the depression. And so there can be a spiral downward that can actually be quite dangerous. And so that's the one kind of major caveat of word of warning that I would give to folks is, you know, whether, again, it's you or someone else in your life who's using one of these platforms, to just really be aware that it's not a substitute for therapy. And there are some potential dangers with, you know, the way that that conversation may go that could really actually worsen mental health and even suicide risk.
Dr. Alfie, what have your observations been as the use of AI has grown exponentially in the last 6 months?
The upside is a wealth of information at your fingertips, right? There are all these different AI platforms that you can use. So I would say if you want to find good information and you get the right chatbot or the right AI system, not only is it going to give you good information, this is what I want to signal to people, you also want the ones that are going to tell you what their sources are. I can name 1,000 of them, but there's one that I use and it always gives me sources. That is key because you don't want to be basing your what you do on misinformation. So that's one. I think for a lot of young people, what they've found is that the convenience of AI, this is on your phone, it's on your iPad, it's on your laptop, it is right there in your face. So if you're struggling with something, a lot of these AI systems have a feature where you can talk to the device and they'll talk back to you, right? So people, what are young people, a lot of young people doing? They're using that as a form of therapy. I don't know that that's necessarily good because remember, AI, you train AI, you teach AI what to give back to you. Do you know what I'm saying? And so the idea is if you're teaching AI what to give back to you, then are you really getting what you need or are you getting what AI has learned you want to hear? Right.
So it's kind of validating the feelings
that you're
having.
Just validating what you already have. Yeah. And so that's a part of it, too. I saw a stat from the American Psychological Association that said over 80% of the information that people are consuming around mental health specifically, 80% of that information is incorrect because they're not getting it from experts, so to speak. And there are multiple kinds of experts. They're getting it from all over the place. So I think that there are ways in which we want to benefit from AI. Check your sources. The information is readily available and accessible, but there are also ways in which we want to be mindful and careful about how we're consuming that information and not replacing human interaction for therapy with a bot that's telling you basically what you want to hear. It's not pushing you. It's not asking you to grow. It's not really necessarily benefiting you as much as sitting with a real live human, like a real live boy, like Pinocchio, a real live human to sit with that person and get the benefit of their wisdom, knowledge, experience, expertise related to your mental health.
What are some of the like healthy practices that people can do just as far as like not being consumed by social media, by AI, like, you know, go out, touch grass?
Yeah, literally. There are a couple things, three or four that come to mind. They have timers. Every device has almost every device has a timer. I happen to be an Apple iPhone girl. It has a timer on it. You can set a timer to tell you when to log off, to send you a little reminder to remind you to log off of whatever social media platform you're on. That's one. Another is you can literally outside of the apps, you can set a timer on your phone, right? That's easy. Like a couple clicks with your thumbs or whatever, and you can get a reminder. You've been on for an hour. It's time to get off. What I also like to tell people is you have to give yourself time to acclimate to the idea of managing and controlling the time that you spend on social media. So don't set yourself up for failure. If you're on social media, all you have to do is look at the weekly recap. If you're on social media 6-7 hours a day, which is close to the average, mind you, for our young people, then don't expect the very next day, I'm going cold turkey. I'm never going to use it because that's not going to happen. No. Instead, you sort of wean yourself off of it. I'm going to go down to 6 hours. I'm going to go down to 5 or whatever the case may be. And then finally, I think it is really thinking about, can you consume your social media in concentrated buckets? I'm going to give myself this hour each day. I'm going to around the same time, not first thing in the morning, as soon as you open your eyes. That's not the time. But can I give myself some structured time where I'm going to focus on this and then I can go off and do other things? I think those are the things that really help us understand and conceptualize how much time am I spending doing this? And then how much time can I realistically expect to cut down given what my past history is, and giving ourselves grace. Like, you're not going to get there in a day. Give yourself time to reacclimate and wean yourself off of constant social media use.
Thank you, Dr. Alfie and Dr. Moutier. I wanted to remind everyone that if you are struggling, the National Suicide Prevention and Crisis Hotline is available 24 hours a day for anyone who is in crisis and needs to talk to someone immediately. You can call or text 988 at any time. There have been some changes to 988 and the access to LGBTQ plus counselors. If you are a member of the LGBTQ plus community, you can still get help through 988, but there is also another wonderful service, the Trevor Project, that specializes with LGBTQ plus persons, and our very own Corey Crockett, a member of the I'm Listening team and a mental health advocate. He's here to talk about that and how we can make use of this vital service. Corey?
Hey, Katie, thanks so much. Grateful to continue this conversation with Jackson Budinger. She is the Senior Director of Communications at the Trevor Project. It's so great to have you here on the show. Thank you for doing this. I think, you know, my first question for you is, can you tell us a little bit about what the mission of the organization is?
So the Trevor Project was founded in 1998. That was when we launched our 24/7 free, confidential suicide prevention hotline, specifically designed for LGBTQ plus young people. We know that approximately 1.8 million LGBTQ young people seriously consider suicide every year in the U.S. LGBTQ young people are more than four times as likely to attempt suicide than their peers. And something that's really important for me to note about that is that LGBTQ young people are not inherently more prone to suicide because of their identities. It's like not something inherent. It's because of the stigma and the rejection and the bullying and the discrimination that they face that leads them to these negative mental health outcomes and to be at higher risk of suicide. So that's just a misconception that I think is important for people to know.
Yeah. Can you tell us about those specific resources that the Trevor Project is offering for LGBTQ plus young people?
We run 24/7 crisis services. So young people can reach out to us via phone, text, or web chat. So they, you know, whichever kind of modality they feel most comfortable with. And we have highly trained counselors who have specific LGBTQ youth competency. That's really the importance of specialized services. And then we have a bunch of preventative programs, which are designed to lower the number of young people entering a mental health crisis or considering suicide in the first place. We have a really active advocacy team that is working on stigma reduction around this community. We have public training. So just all of these things that are trying to address the systemic problems that are causing LGBTQ young people to be at this higher risk of suicide in the first place.
Yeah, we want to make sure that if you're a part of the LGBTQ plus community, you're a gay or queer young person listening to this, you know that there is help for you. You are not alone. There are people that are ready to help you if you find yourself in crisis, or if there's someone who knows a queer young person in their life, a teacher, a parent, a friend. That phone number to call is 1-866-488-7386. You can also text START to 678-678, or you can chat at thetrevorproject.org. And I want to add something that might seem obvious, but get a little clarity here, that the services that the Trevor Project offers is not just for LGBTQ plus young people that are out in their public lives.
Yeah, to anybody listening who is an LGBTQ young person, or like Corey said, any adults out there who have someone in their life who you think might be struggling, this has maybe become a cliche message, but it really does get better. There are so many people who work at the Trevor Project who can relate to what, you know, young LGBTQ young people went through, because they were an LGBTQ young person themselves and did have extremely dark days and dark moments where they could not see a future. I'm telling you, there's another side of it.
Jackson, I want to thank you so much for having this conversation with us, for sharing these resources and for sharing the story and for the work that the Trevor Project does every day. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Corey. It's a really important conversation. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Corey. Now we'll check back in with Carson.
Wow, thanks, Katie. That is some really great stuff there. A reminder that if you are looking for resources on anything that you're hearing during the program or things that we're talking about, we encourage you to visit imlistening.org. And if you find yourself in need of assistance, don't forget, you can call or text the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline by simply dialing 988. Experts are standing by to help you. All right, so we're up and running, and coming up in just a few minutes, a few topics that don't get nearly enough attention: protecting the mental health of our first responders and all those great men and women on the front lines in our communities. We're going to speak with experts on how first responders can prioritize their mental health and how we can help look out for the firefighters and police officers and EMTs and other emergency response workers in our lives. This is I'm Listening.
Okay, forest animals, today is a new day. Kids are coming to the forest, and it's up to us to make their visit a good one. Sparrow.
Yes?
Have you practiced the most popular bird songs for the year?
Of course.
Catchy. I like it. Okay, river.
Dude.
How's the temperature?
It's a refreshing 52 degrees, man. Perfect for a little riverside shoeless relaxation.
Ah, good. Owl, you here?
Of course.
Who's asking? I am. Look, you know the drill. Sleep during the day, scare the kids at night.
Perfect. I love my job.
Oak tree?
Sup?
Still in the same place I left you last year. That's what I like. Consistency.
Well, it's not like I'm going anywhere for the next couple hundred years.
I know. I love it. Turtle. Turtle.
He's not here yet, man.
He's late every morning. You'd think he would have learned by now to leave the night before our meetings. Okay. Squirrel. Has anybody seen Mr. Squirrel?
The forest has been preparing just for you. Visit a forest near you today. To learn more about cool things to do in the forest, visit discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared. It's like tiny nails in the air poke my lungs.
I start to cough.
Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
Today, one out of 13 children suffer from some form of asthma, accounting for nearly one-third of all emergency room visits.
I feel like I'm choking.
It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest. A little whistle sound comes out when I breathe.
But while your child may suffer from asthma, asthma doesn't have to make your child suffer. There are simple ways you can prevent your child's next attack. To learn more, call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. That's 1-866-662-8822. Log on to www.noattacks.org or call your doctor, because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
Welcome back to Odyssey's Mental Health Special, I'm Listening. Back as your host and thrilled to be here yet again. It is me, Carson Daly, and this is so important and fun for me, and I'm honored to be here to lead this conversation and just explore the ways that we can prioritize our own mental health and start supporting each other. If you need someone to talk to right now, please, you can call or text 988. This is new. It's the new easy number for the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Again, you would use this like you do 911 for other emergencies. Use 988 for any sort of mental health crisis or when you need to talk right away. There is somebody standing by who can help you. Let's hear from some of our guests who implement a variety of ways they tackle their own stresses and anxieties. Rob Thomas.
There are some things that people are going through that are insurmountable, and I think to just kind of chalk it down to you're going to be okay, that's yeah. Falls flat. It's not, because maybe you're not. You don't know what their situation is. Right. But just being able to talk about it in a way that maybe you couldn't 15, 20 years ago, that in itself is a solace.
Billy Idol.
Well, of course, people understand a lot more that a lot of people are struggling with sort of mental health and everything. And I think we were very aware of it back in the 70s and stuff, but there again, people just didn't know quite how to deal with it.
Kane Brown.
Being vulnerable with my own music has helped me with my health journey, just by talking about it and, you know, by talking about it and opening up to the world, really. It kind of was a warning for other people around me, and it has helped me just grow and kind of talk.
Neo.
I feel it is important to continue having conversations about mental health, because life is precious, and if we're not talking about it, there are dire consequences to that. You know, people taking their lives, people taking other people's lives. None of that needs to happen. So yes, very, very important that we continue the conversation. If there's something going on, talk about it. Get it out. That's the best way to solve the problem. You got to get it out.
Benny Blanco.
You know, I get crippled by anxiety, and it's okay to not be okay all the time.
more people should just be real about it, and you should talk about it and talk to other people and find someone great that you can talk to about it.
In a bit, we're going to talk about our first responders, service members, and frontline workers. We're talking police officers and firefighters, armed forces, yes, doctors, nurses, all the staff, everybody who's on the front lines every day. We're going to hear from a clinical psychologist working with the NYPD every day. But first, as many as 1 in 7 new mothers experience postpartum depression, yet it still feels like such a taboo topic. And some estimates may even be underestimated, since so many cases go unreported due to stigma or lack of awareness. Katie Neal and Dr. Alfie Breland-Noble are digging in to show new and expectant mothers that they're not alone and teach the rest of us about this commonly shared experience.
Thank you, Carson. Dr. Alfie, next, I would really love to discuss postpartum depression. This, to me, feels like one of the areas of mental health where we are seeing a great deal of destigmatization and more women are sharing their stories. Are you also seeing that?
100%. I'm thinking a little bit about how maybe 20 years ago when I had my kids, nobody, if anybody was talking about it, it was very limited. And so it was almost like hush hush. You just weren't supposed to. And, you know, I remember my OBGYN asking a couple questions. They were great, by the way. I don't want to run them down, but I don't really remember having an in-depth conversation. And I'm going to tell you who changed it for me. Hayden Panettiere. When she came out and talked about having postpartum depression, for me, I felt like the world just kind of opened up. I was like, oh God, people are talking about this. And I know there have been plenty of other people who've had those conversations both prior to her and after her, but she was kind of a line in the sand for me. And so I do believe now we talk a lot more about it, and I will give credit where credit is due. Millennial women, millennial moms are very open and comfortable, I think more so than Gen X and boomers, talking about this is a part of their struggle. And what does that do? That destigmatizes it for the Gen Z mommies and then the future Gen Alpha mommies, right? And so it's, yes, a lot more prevalent. I'm really happy to see it. And it impacts so many women. How do we not have those conversations?
I know, it really is. It's so funny that you say hush hush, because I do feel like, you know, like you were saying, 10, 15 years ago, I'd be like, oh, she's just not doing really well, right? She's having a hard time with a new baby or something, you know? And it wasn't really like, no one was talking about it. And meanwhile, all these women are internalizing these horrible feelings like, oh my God, I'm not bonding with my baby. Do I not, like, what am I doing wrong? Could you speak to what are some of the signs as a woman that you should look for? And then what are signs as a partner that you can look for your significant other?
So I will say, you know, there's the blues and then there's postpartum depression. Lots of people get baby, you know, they call them baby blues, right? Where you're a little down, you have low energy. But, you know, sometimes we dismiss that because it's like, well, I'm tired because this baby doesn't sleep and I don't get to sleep and I'm not following the advice that says you sleep when the baby sleeps. Like, I didn't do that. I was guilty. But I think what people can look for is some things that are very similar to how we typically would look at depression. Right. But there's some parts of it that are specific to the relationship with the baby. Right. So if you find yourself consistently fatigued beyond what's normal for you. Right. And outside of the circumstance of caring for this little human who needs you 24/7, if you're tearful all the time, if you're sad all the time, if you, in addition to having low energy, your brain is foggy all the time. You know, if those are things that are happening to you consistently, more often than not, over a 2-week stretch of time, and the baby specific things is you kind of don't want to even look at the baby. When you hear the baby crying, it just sort of grates your nerves, right? You have, for some women, they have, I want to find the right word, less than positive feelings toward the baby, right? Maybe there's some anger, right? Sometimes depression and sadness can manifest itself in a masked way. We get angry and we get highly irritable and the tiniest thing bothers us. So if you're seeing those things happen to you, a cluster of those things, 4 or 5 over a 2-week period, that's when you need to start being mindful of maybe I need to talk to somebody, maybe I need some help. And when I say talk to somebody, that doesn't mean go straight to a mental health professional, although we would like you to. That may mean you talk to your loved one, your partner, your spouse, and try to get a sense of what are they seeing. So the same things that I described we should be looking for in ourselves, those are the things that a partner can look for, right? Is this person refusing to get out the bed? You know, are they, every time I say one little thing, they blow up at me? You know, if you as a partner see that cluster of things too, it's okay to ask. I'm just checking on you. Are you okay? You seem agitated. it? Is there anything I can do to help? And then the job, the requirement that we have is if we're going to open the door to the conversation, we have to be willing to sit and listen with love, listen with empathy, not listen to fix. Nobody wants you to fix them. They want you to help them.
Exactly. And, you know, for as much as I feel like there's so much more awareness around talking about postpartum depression, I'm not really sure, like, how is postpartum depression treated? Like, what are the steps past when you're like, I think something's wrong?
So it's treated in much the same way that other forms of depression are treated. Remember, I always talk about the fast way, the slow way, the best way. What literature and research tell us, right? I was on a committee for putting together guidelines for the treatment of depression, including postpartum depression. And what we believe is that cognitive behavioral therapy, where you're talking about thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, that approach to therapy is teaching you a skill set that, and personally, I think is a life lesson, right? You can use it in all parts of life, but it is specific to managing your depression. So the combination of cognitive behavioral therapy and for people who are comfortable, psychotropic medications, antidepressants, that is what we believe is the best way to deal with postpartum depression. And that's what we encourage people to look for. If you can't find somebody who practices CBT, go find somebody who's licensed and able to provide talk therapy. They can have other approaches that they use, but CBT is what we believe is the best, primarily because it's the one that's been studied the most.
Thank you, Dr. Alfie. Our next topic I'm really looking forward to diving into is first responders and mental health. I like to bring back Dr. Moutier. Dr. Moutier, I really want for mental health to be talked about freely everywhere, but perhaps an emphasis on that within the community of first responders, because I do feel like there is a particularly heavy stigma in that community. Can you talk about why that exists?
Well, whenever you have a profession where people are drawn to it perhaps in the first place because they can help others, it tells you something about kind of how they're wired, perhaps. And it's not to say that first responders all have the same, you know, personality or makeup. That's not the case at all. We're all different and unique. But there is something that draws us and to certain professions. And then also, they tend to be professions where there's a lot of self-sacrifice and work and competition to get in the first place, then let alone to kind of function in the job. And so that can be across a lot of different types of occupations where what I'm describing is the case. And I think it's hard to switch mindsets when your identity has been formed and shaped around being a caregiver or a helper to others, that to realize that you yourself deserve that same level of, you know, potential need for support, for treatment, for mental health treatment, physical health treatment, all the things like that. There was some data that found that, for example, physicians, the majority of them were actually not in physical health maintenance care themselves, let alone seeking mental health care. And so, there's a lot of different reasons for it. I think there's also kind of the old school culture that gets embedded in training programs and in workplaces where it's kind of a tough person mentality, where it's that stoic, old school image of holding it all together and chin up and suck it up that had been celebrated as a sign of strength. And now we're realizing that we can be really tough and really strong and also need help at times. And that the message that I'm seeing getting out there into some first responder communities is that leaning on each other and seeking help are signs of strength and intelligence to know when you need that extra support so that you can preserve not only your health, but you can keep helping others in the way that is so important that you keep doing. So it can be really turned on its head in that way and turned into a sign of strength I think when first responders who have been through a crisis or if they have dealt with PTSD and now they're learning how to manage it through any number of ways, you know, support groups or treatment or advocacy, when they tell their stories, that's a ripple effect that inspires anyone else, because there is an extra load of trauma and sort of vicarious trauma that many first responders are experiencing as part of their job. And so I love how the lived experience community can really change the game in terms of stigma, like nobody's business. Science is really important. We need to know what is the reality and the data and what is evidence-based in order to, you know, to get better and feel better. But it's not going to do the whole thing when it comes to changing culture and changing people's behavior.
Absolutely. It is something that will take some time. One of the things that I was thinking about as you were talking is, again, like, you've got to put your mask on before you help someone else. And for people who are so drawn to help and care for others, it's almost important for them to hear that, like, the care that you're giving, the quality of that would be so much better and maybe more effective once you've taken care of yourself. And I also just think, like, that community of people deserves, you know, access to all of the mental health resources. If I had gone through in a day what a first responder goes through every day, I would need therapy probably for the year.
Yeah, look, the occupational exposures are real. I think, keep in mind, though, that people work really hard to get into their professions of choice. And so those experiences on their own are really, really tough. But if the individual's mental health is really robust and strong and they're doing well, they can cope with a lot. But the issue is that our mental health is dynamic. It's changing all the time. And it's usually multifaceted. Like, there's usually several things going on in a first responder's life that are going to be the reason that their mental health is deteriorating, or that their tendency to lean on alcohol or other substances is becoming more intense. It's usually not just one thing or just the stress at work. There's, you know, any number of things that go on in all of our personal lives. And there's also genetics and family history. And as much as we don't necessarily learn this in school, our childhood experiences, and especially trauma, if left unaddressed, are still in there somewhere and can be reactivated, or can contribute to the way a current stressful experience, that its impact on our mental health can be different for those who have that unaddressed trauma from the past. So, you know, I think the bottom line is that...
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Fee and fees apply. In app only.
Make money from your podcast with the Odyssey Creator Lab. You create the show, we bring the advertisers. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com.
We can all be forces for good in our workplace, and first responders included, where the little things that we do, where we speak up when we notice someone it may be going through a tough time, and we give them our unconditional support as a colleague and listen to them, open up that space, or even just little signals that we might give that say that you're a safe person to talk to about this kind of stuff. And those little signals can look like sharing a little bit of vulnerability of whatever's going on in your own life. It doesn't have to be big stuff, can be big or little, but it signals to the people around us that we don't have shame attached to struggle. It's just like, this is normal. It's human to struggle. It's very exciting. You know, there's lots going on in first responder communities around pro mental health advocacy and suicide prevention. films being made, you know, workplace efforts. Peers are getting trained to be mental health supports to one another. At AFSP, we have something called the Interactive Screening Program that's being utilized in some first responder workplaces. So lots of different things that can help.
Thank you, Dr. Moutier. Also joining us is Dr. Adam Bloom, who is a board-certified forensic psychologist. In addition to his private practice, Dr. Bloom also serves as the director of the NYPD Medical Division, the Psychological Evaluation Section. Dr. Bloom, could you speak about what first responders are going through and how their mental health challenges are unique?
To me, the biggest concern for first responders is their chronic exposure to trauma. Okay, so think about your police officer, your firefighter, your 911 operator, your EMS driver. I mean, they're being exposed to trauma at the level that most people in the general population will never experience.
Yeah.
So, and if you think, if you just think about the police officers, for example, they're probably being exposed to maybe 200 or more critical incidents a year, right? And if you think about a 20-year career, you're talking about exposure to thousands and thousands of critical incidents. Same goes for firefighters and other first responders. So to me, that's really the critical issue, how we can educate our first responders to kind of process their trauma exposure and to incorporate, balanced lifestyle and really to reduce the stigma, because as we all know, when it comes to first responders and particularly firefighters and law enforcement officers, there is still a tremendous stigma about, raising your hand and reaching out for mental health services. So we talk about that a lot. We kind of advise our first responders to ask for help. We want them to ask for help, but there's still a big process to get kind of chisel away at that.
Where do you think that stigma stems from, or where does that come from?
I think the stigma is an old school kind of thought process for first responders. It was, they were taught generally, and we hear this from our older first responders, not so much the younger ones, but, the older police officers or firefighters, they were kind of taught, oh, you have to deal with that. You have to learn how to deal with that. Like, go to the locker room, put some water on your face, and get back out there. Like, or, file that away. Don't let it bother you. That kind of mentality. That was the old school way of thinking about dealing with trauma for first responders. Now we're kind of teaching them that it's not a matter of if you're going to have a reaction to trauma. It's a matter of when you're going to have it. We know you're going to have it. I often teach the new recruits and the rookies, I use the analogy of think about water coming into the house, right? Water is leaking in the roof of your house. You don't know where it's going to come out. You don't know when it's going to come out. And maybe just a few drops will come out, but maybe your whole kitchen ceiling or basement is going to be flooded. So it's really an attempt to prepare first responders to recognize the signs of their trauma reactions, to learn how to deal with it, and to not be freaked out when it happens, because that could resemble like a full blown panic attack or a heart attack or something. And we want people just to understand what's going on, to expect that you're going to have a trauma reaction, to think that you're going to do this work for 20 years and be fit for duty every single day is kind of misleading, right?
From the time that you started to today, have you seen a shift towards the destigmatization around conversations surrounding mental health? And if you could talk about that.
Yeah, I do see a shift. I think, as I said, getting in front of police officers on a daily basis, from day one on in their career and periodically through their training, you know, their first year, their first few years. That's the way we're going to reduce the stigma, because every time that one of my psychologists gets in front of a first responder and has a conversation with them, and that first responder returns to their job and duties, that normalizes the process. So we are seeing a shift, yes, but it's going to take time, because, you know, like I said, in 20 more years, every first responder will have been trained in this model. But, you know, the way to chip at it is to do it, you know, little by little, and just normalize the process.
We've gotten to touch on so many great things. Is there anything that we haven't spoken about yet regarding your work with first responders, or anything that you want first responders to hear from you to know before we wrap up?
Yeah. I mean, the main message I give in all my talks or lectures is that, you know, it's not a weakness to ask for help. It's really a sign of strength. And, you know, it only takes a split second impulsive decision when you're going down that, you know, rabbit hole in that, you know, dark place. But when you have a firearm, that split second decision becomes lethal. So firearm access is critical. So if you do have a firearm and you're struggling, you know, lock that firearm up, or give it to your partner, or give it to your supervisor. Just take it out of the equation. You know, I would say, like, if you worked at any other job, like you work at a bank, right, for 20 years, you're going to take sick days. You're going to take time off. You're going to take leave time, right? But many first responders feel that that's not an option for them, right? They feel like they need to be fit for duty every day of their career. And that's really a very high bar to set for yourself.
Thank you, Dr. Bloom. Dr. Alfie, something I want to make sure that we touch on is mental health across different walks of life. We know that conversations surrounding mental health can look very different across cultures, across backgrounds. Can you speak to that a little, please?
Yeah, I think part of recognizing that is that for every single one of us, because our family dynamics are so different, I want to normalize the idea that there are differences for all of us, right? We're all engaging in these things in different ways. And I think when you layer on different parts of identity, or like culture, right? Like where you come from, did your family immigrate? You know, were they always here? Like whatever your family history is, I think it's important to recognize that the single greatest source of information for you in terms of how to broach these subjects is yourself and your experience within your family. So I can tell you, you know, Katie Neal, the famous Katie Neal, can tell you what you should do. But if it doesn't work for you, you will know that immediately. So like, for example, in my family, we didn't really grow up talking about that stuff until I became a mental health professional. Now everybody's talking about it because there's somebody in the family they can go to. Sort of like I have a first cousin who's a nurse. Anything medical, everybody goes to Cousin Sandra. Do you know what I mean? And so you've established that for yourself. I think the key is recognizing that there's nuance in every single family, recognizing that for many people, there are aspects of their identity that have been marginalized. And so the more identities you have that are marginalized, it's recognizing probably the less likely people in your group will be ready to talk about these things, because who wants to feel even more outside the circle? So I think it's giving people grace. I think it's recognizing we all are bringing differences to this. And I think it is recognizing we have a family history, we have cultural history that we can use and build on to help us integrate our culture and these conversations around mental health. And I'll give you a quick example. I'm aware of groups where the conversation around mental health won't start with a direct discussion of mental health. It'll start with like a cultural festival. So you bring everybody together, you have the food, you have the dances, you know what I mean? You might have the modes of dress. And then as a part of that festival, you'll squeeze in a conversation about mental health, and you'll have somebody from that cultural group standing up there who's a mental health professional or an activist or, you know, an influencer around mental health, and they will share a little bit about their own journey. So what that does is it's giving people a visual cue. This is somebody who gets me and people who look like me, and it's giving them another cue. Oh, maybe I too can think about this mental health stuff slightly differently. So it's use the tools you have, use the knowledge you have, use your own background. Use yourself as a tool to help people see that these conversations can be okay.
Thank you, Dr. Alfie. And thank you, Dr. Christine Moutier and Dr. Bloom for joining us. I always find these conversations so helpful and so fulfilling. And I hope that if you have joined us at any point in the show, you've learned something that you can take with you to implement in your own life. Thank you for joining us for I'm Listening. Carson, back to you. Any final thoughts?
We could spend so much time digging into the many facets of what makes up our mental health and how we can support each other. But even just spending a little bit of time today shining light on this topic, I think is making a big difference. And you, by the way, are making the biggest difference in your own life and community simply by devoting even just a sliver of time to your own mental health well-being. Thank you so much for our experts that joined us tonight, the great Dr. Alfie, Dr. Moutier, Dr. Bloom, all of our guests who shared their stories with us, all the artists that reached out and shared. We appreciate you. Of course, so many of you listening, please remember, you're not alone. And it's okay to not be okay. And during this National Suicide Prevention Month, please check out the resources we've got available from our partner groups like the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention at imlistening.org. I'm also on the board of directors of a great nonprofit out of New York called Project Healthy Minds that also has a great guide that might help you as well. We encourage you to check out PHM. The podcast version of the show will be available shortly on the free Odyssey app and at imlistening.org as well. Thank you again for sharing in this conversation with us. We know how important it is because talk saves lives. I'm Carson Daly. Thank you for listening.
If you came across someone struggling with hunger, how would you recognize them? By their clothes? Their age? The way they speak? Would you notice a 16-year-old boy who got his first job,
not for extra spending money, but to help feed his little sisters?
Or a mother who's in between jobs and sometimes goes to bed hungry so her kids can have dinner? Or a 14-year-old girl who signs up to every after-school activity, not to make friends, but just to get something to eat? Or a retiree who fell ill and had to choose
between getting medicine or groceries.
I am the one in eight Americans who struggle with hunger. People you pass by every day but never knew were hungry. I am hunger in America.
Hunger can be hard to recognize. Learn why at IamHungerInAmerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America, 200 Food Banks Strong, and the Ad Council.
Welcome everyone to West High School Spring Fling. Hey, where we at? Where we at?
All right, I've gone through all the tracks. Just move through the beats. Do your thing.
All right, everyone, let's hear it for West High's own Brooke Turner, aka DJ Hook.
Scratching up my first school dance takes confidence. So getting into college, I've got what it takes. Okay, I went through the practice sessions. I slept good. I feel good.
We will now begin the test. Please take out your pencils.
I got this.
We're all good at something. Maybe it's breakdancing or skateboarding or video games. Whatever you're good at, you had the skills to make it happen. And those same skills will help us get to college. Visit knowhowtogo.org to learn what you should be doing right now to prepare for college. Start taking the steps at knowhowtogo.org.
I've got what it takes. So do you.
Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Make money from your podcast with the Odyssey Creator Lab. You create the show, we bring the advertisers. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com.